Welcome to Talentless, the podcast that's all HR, all talent, and zero fluff. Hosted by industry talent leaders, Desiree Goldie and Ashley King, and made for recruiters who think of talent outside of the box. They're here to dig into the heart of what makes workplaces tick and sometimes blow up. They are not afraid to get into the messy, the meaningful, and the downright motivating. So buckle up, because they're here to make you the best in the business. Now, let's get to work.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another fantastic episode of the Talentless Podcast. You ever apply to a job only to feel like your resume got thrown into the void? Yeah, same. Candidate experience isn't just a phrase. It's a first impression, the brand, the make or break. Today, we're opening the candidate experience files with none other than the queen of candidate experience herself, Bonnie Dilper. Yes, that Bonnie. She is a recruiting leader at Zapier and a true advocate for the candidate. She's a former educator turned talent leader, a TikTok star, a writer of a popular newsletter called Landed, and an advisor to many. Today, we're talking real strategies, real equity, and real fixes for a process that's way overdue for a glow up. Let's get it.
Yeah, what an intro. I feel like I have a very, very high bar now.
The literal queen. Like, there's England, and then there's Canada experience. And that's it. Those are the only queens we have.
I love it. All right, let's start it off. Bonnie, what are your initial thoughts on the candidate experience? Meaning what? Yeah, talk to me about that.
Like the current state of
it? Yes, the current state.
I mean, holistically, just I feel like this is a real struggle, and a lot of companies, I mean, the last decade, like, recruiting has changed a lot. I mean, we're just getting such high application volumes that I think a lot of companies have really fallen short in terms of the experience they're creating for candidates. And, you know, even places that used to pride themselves on being really candidate centered and working to win candidates over, especially kind of post pandemic, as the job market has shifted from favoring employees to employers. I just think a lot of companies have felt like that's the thing they can kind of sacrifice. And I mean, candidates are throwing applications into the void, never hearing back, going through multiple interviews, not getting, you know, not finding out where they stand, or getting, you know, a form email after going through four different interviews and these sort of things that to me are just pretty unacceptable. I've been a victim of some of that as well in my
haven't career, we all? So,
And so I think it's a real miss for a lot of companies, and is also leading to so much like disillusionment among people.
And candidates. And you know, what do you think the role that recruiters should play and the impact they make on this, right?
I mean, I think recruiters have a lot of influence over it. I do think some of it is like about resourcing, about the tools that people have available to them, about the expectations that companies set. Certain parts of the candidate experience, there are just companies who, because we live in a litigious society, say we're not giving anyone feedback because it opens up a level of risk. We're not going to do anything other than templated emails because that's just a way that everything's approved through legal. And, you know, there's not a lot of judgment allowed for recruiting, but in places where recruiters do have more autonomy and ownership, I mean, you get to decide what expectations and what standards you set for people. And I also think most recruiters should have the ability to sort of influence upwards, like influence their managers, their directors, their people leaders. So, and sort of connect the dots between how a poor candidate experience could negatively impact the brand of the company, both as an employer and as a product. I mean, if a bunch of people are having a terrible experience applying to your company, they might be less inclined to use your product, or, you know, they might be out there saying really negative things about your company, and that leads to eroding your brand. So I think that there are really negative implications for employers as well on this front.
Could I ask, what do you think, and this is not a question we prep for, so however you want to respond, please do. What do you think is a core pillar of a good candidate experience? And then what do you think is a core pillar of a bad? Like, what are the symptom signs where it's like, if a recruiter's listening to this and is like, I have no manager, I don't know if what I'm doing is good or bad. What would you say is like a running theme between those two? Pollers.
I mean, one thing I would just say to someone is like, if you were an applicant, what would you want? And I think generally, if you just like bring that lens to everything, what would you want? And what would make you feel like a human and seen in a process? And what would make you feel unvalued and try to do the things that lean closer to the things that would make you feel human. Some of those things, I work for an automation and AI company. I mean, literally, like, we're using all sorts of automations.
Right.
We still have every week, pretty much, someone puts up our rejection email on LinkedIn and says, like, this is the best rejection I've ever gotten. Like, we get, you know, people thanking us for, and it is an automated templated message that they're getting. But, you know, so I think a lot of these things don't have to take a lot of time. But, you know, simple things. If someone applies to your company, they deserve an update, you know? Having expectations at Zapier, we have a 7-day expectation. I can't say we meet it all the time, but we try to make sure people aren't going more than, you know, we target 7 days, that they never go more than 7 days without hearing from us. Could just be like, hey, we're still looking at applications. We don't have an update yet, but something to let them know, like, you didn't just throw an application into the void. We didn't just, you know, reject you and not even bother to tell you, those sorts of things. I sent one last week to about 100 people on an application that we got just hundreds of apps on, just hadn't gotten through all of them yet. And I mean, I would say probably 70% of them responded and were just like so grateful just for a simple update that took me, you know, 5-6 minutes total.
Isn't that kind of sad that we're grateful to get rejected in a nice way?
Like, it's
such a bizarre.
But I do honestly think, like, so many people aren't even getting that, or aren't getting an update that says, we got your application, we're still working on it, like, we haven't forgotten about you, those sorts of things. Thank you for the interview. We're still talking to other people. We haven't decided if you're going to move forward yet, but, like, wanted to let you know that we're still, you know, we're not ghosting you.
Right.
Those sorts of things. So I think these are really simple things that people can do. At Zapier, we do actually give feedback to anyone that's interviewed. I hear a lot of companies are really risk averse, so they tell their teams not to do that because it opens that level of risk. But you can go the opposite route and you can just train your recruiting team on what is acceptable feedback. I think this is also a good use case for AI, where a recruiter can run something through AI and say, like, what are the risks of sending this to a candidate? That sort of thing. But if someone has taken the time to interview with us, they're going to get some form of feedback. If they've gotten to later stages, they're going to get a live debrief of their process, that sort of thing. And I would say, you know, it's 50-50 if candidates take us up on that. But, like, a lot of them will get on and they're generally really grateful. I've had very few experiences where someone is super negative, you know, two or three, but, like, for the most part, people are just really appreciative to have the chance to talk through it and also, like, reiterate their interest or talk about other opportunities that could fit, those sorts of things. And I've seen, like, a lot of those people come back, apply over and over again. Honestly, I've made several hires in the last quarter from people who had applied numerous times and there just hadn't been the right fit. And then this time around, as we opened similar roles, we were able to just go straight to them and say, hey,
Great. You know, the live debrief is something that I think is
I know. Like, my face the moment you said that, I was like, no, hold on, I want to make sure I'm hearing this right. Because I honestly, and I think that you're right, like, for me, the core pillar of what's good is transparent communication fluently, right? The pillar of what's bad is just, like, no effort, period. Honestly, like you were saying, how people are so excited, people will do anything just for communication, even if it's negative. Let alone Zapier, who's clearly doing beneficial communication. But I have got to know this feedback loop. Talk to me about how Zapier kind of made the decision to do that, and then what strategic scaffolding you have around that process to ensure that everything is legal savvy. Like, if someone else wanted to implement a feedback loop like this, that was actually intrinsic to benefit the candidate, what does that look like?
So for us, it's if someone makes it to our skills interview stage, which is basically the step that comes after the hiring manager. And so typically at that point, they've done some sort of either skills test, a live, you know, there could be a presentation, something along those lines. And there's kind of two reasons for that. One, if they've made it to that stage, they're a strong candidate. You know, they made it past the hiring manager. If you make it past the hiring manager, in my opinion, like, there's a really good chance that you could be a great fit for that role, even if you're not going to get it, because a bunch of other people are too. It's essentially a hiring manager said, they've got everything I'm looking for. And now it's just kind of the nuances that last like 5%. And so part of it for us is like, these are really strong candidates. This might not have been the right one, but it could be the right opportunity in 6 months. And so it's a way for us to actually like cultivate that relationship and keep them like invested. And we also feel like if you put the amount of time it takes to do some sort of a skills assessment, which could have taken could be 30 minutes, it could be 2 hours, you know, that you put more time into our process. So we want to make sure that that gets valued with more of our time as well. So what that looks like is a recruiter will get on. Yeah. Oh.
Yes. No, I was just going to say, yeah. I kind of, even just hearing you talk about it, I can't express to you how much I love this, because let me tell you, as a candidate who is watching people give effort to individuals who don't create any revenue, make any impact on this business, but yet we're giving time and hours, tells me everything I need to know about the internal life of Zapier. And I see why you have so many people reapplying, because yeah. they, holy smack, I'm on the outside yeah. and this looks great. Y'all remember whenever we called her the queen and everyone was like, calm down, all right, like, we don't know Queen of England, like, no. But then that now they're listening and they're like, holy smack, she's queen right. of the whole world, like, what has happened?
They're it. Like, I'm not doing anything right, I don't know yeah. what I'm doing here, like,
I'm so glad they all came.
I have a second of the day after this.
I mean,
a confidence boost,
I'm telling you.
Well, I'm going to be honest. I mean, I've seen the worst of the worst, right?
Yeah.
You know, just as my, as being a candidate and having to follow totally. Up numerous times, not getting feedback, not really hearing what I did wrong. I mean, yeah. that in this job market, that feels horrifying, right?
Yeah.
Because you just don't know how to even course correct maybe for your next thing. And so this for me is everything. Like, it's, yeah. it's everything. Well, and I would definitely take you guys up. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, I always ask them, like, do you have any feedback for us? Like, how was the process for you? Yeah, you know, those yeah. sorts of things. And sometimes we'll get good stuff. Like, sometimes people are like, there was too much communication. I got like 4 reminders about this. That was excessive. You know, and I'm like, that's good to know. We actually yeah. recently collapsed a couple of things because I heard that a few times from people and was like, yeah, we can adjust that.
I would want to be over communicated too. So I'd be like, yes.
I think like we have reminders set up where it's like in 24 hours. In 1 hour, and maybe yeah.
gotcha.
Especially gotcha. People are like, I'm organized. I have my own calendar, like, you know. But yeah, it's and for our team's enablement, like, one, we set the expectation, and I mean, very simple stuff. We created a template. It's like, hey, you need to always populate a link, like literally right here, before you can send the simple things. And we have done some training on what kind of feedback is and isn't, you know, acceptable.
Oh, okay.
Perfect. Yeah.
That's awesome. And that's something, I mean, you do a lot of that like with people throughout the process, because that should hold true in the notes that you're sharing, that sort of thing. And usually they will have a little bit of like prep so they can kind of go through all of the scorecards, or they'll align with the hiring manager. Like, what is the feedback that we want to, you know, share? And sometimes the feedback is honestly like, there is no real feedback. You were awesome. Just someone else had this product experience. Someone else was a Zapier user already. Like, it's little things like that. That so it may not be as actionable. And then sometimes there is something that it's, you know, we just saw that like your approach to this didn't quite align with what we were looking for, and here's like what we're looking for. And so maybe that's a skill that you can build or something you can practice.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think that there is as much risk as people think there is. Like I said, we have had a handful of times where people, you get on a call and get real, you know, have someone that's kind of like mistreats the recruiter, who is like over, you know, kind of in attack mode, but it's rare. Yeah. I've seen probably, you know, I can count on one hand how many times this has happened over the course of like 3.5 years here. And so in my opinion, it's worth that risk to give 99.9% of people a great experience. And I think what a lot of companies say is, because of that 0.1% of risk, we're not going to do what's best.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which is kind of weird. Right.
Yeah. Do you have anything in place that is like a mechanism to be a resource for the recruiters if they have like those terrible exchanges where it's like, oh crap, like, do they go talk to an HRB? Like, what happens next? If
yeah, they can escalate it. Okay. Yeah. And if someone, I think every recruiter knows, if you get on, you know, have an interaction with someone and there's like negativity, then you can say, hey, like, that's all I have for today. Best of luck. And, you know, move forward. Also, there are a few occasions where I've told people, just given the interactions like we've had with someone, don't actually offer the live debrief.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get signal ahead of it. And so, you know, if something happened in like an interaction with a hiring manager, let's say, or something, like you have some signal about someone, or they've already been sort of rude to the team, that kind of thing. So again, really rare. I'm talking about like one or two times these things happen. But I think recruiters on our team at least like feel some empowerment to recognize, like, protect yourself.
There's that word. Yeah. That's the best word ever, right? They are empowered to do escalate, I think, to do, it's huge.
And judgment, like, right. Cultivate judgment in your recruiting team. I think so many recruiters feel forced to operate as just like process executors, and I have to do this step with exactly this template. And we try to have our recruiters feel ownership over, like, if this isn't serving you, if this doesn't make sense, then don't do it. Like, we will understand. We will have your back. If I were to see that a recruiter never did their debriefs or never offered them, I would say something. But if I see it happen one off, my assumption is not going to be that the recruiter is being lazy or dropping the ball. It's going to be that they exercised their good judgment and decided it didn't make sense in this case.
Yeah. I'm curious about the amount of time, more time it takes to put this effort in. It's great, but if I'm a recruiting person of one, right? How much time can I really dedicate to doing that? And I wonder, have you seen it kind of make it hard for recruiters to fit these things in with the time allotted they have in a day? Or have you not really, because you have it kind of spread out and allocated correctly?
I think our team is resourced well. And if you think about it, because we're doing that late stage, perhaps for each role or that mid stage, like after the hiring manager, maybe 4 or 5 people for any given position are making it to that stage. And then of those, maybe 2 are rejected. And of those 2, possibly only 1 actually schedules, because we first send the email letting them know, hey, we're not moving forward. Here's a bit of high level feedback. Like, you know, the team ultimately felt that some other candidates had stronger project management skills, whatever. High level feedback. If you want to talk further, here's a link to set up time. So that's what candidates get. And I honestly find that a lot of them, that's sufficient, and they don't want that live time. And so, you know, again, for any given role, you might see like 1 person. So when you think about that, they're probably doing 3 or 4 of these a week, 10, 15 minutes a call, you know, you're looking at an hour of your week. So I think sometimes also these things feel daunting when you think about it and, you know,
grand scheme.
And when we first rolled it out, the team felt that way too. Like, I have to debrief every, you know, it's like, once you actually get into it, you realize it's not that bad.
Yeah.
I love it.
Not much.
So where would you say, because I know we're talking about candidate experience, and I'm just curious on your thoughts, because for me, I feel candidate experience starts with like the talent brand. Like, it starts with their access points. Where can I find you? Who are the people that you're with? How can I apply? What is the apply path? Even like those steps, to me, all of that is candidate experience before we've ever even spoken to a recruiter, like touch. So talk to us a little bit about how Zach kind of does this full encompassing view of candidate experience, and what things have y'all done to help actually help recruiters conserve time, maybe even putting more things in your job description that are more direct to where you save minutes in the screen.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
So one thing is we only have applications through our direct website, which I think part of why I always tell people like not to use the easy applies is not every company has that like kind of filtering. And so I have worked in environments where as recruiters, like the team was actually having to go to like 6 different places, check applications. Sometimes you have the same person in all of these different places and you know, a lot of this like manual, like busy work. Whereas, you know, in our case, it's all coming through our standard application. We have application questions. We actually don't require resumes to apply here, but we have application questions where you kind of need to show a little bit of your skills that align with the role. And those are really helpful for culling the pool quickly because, for example, for our technical support roles, they have to build a Zap. So because the team wants people who know the product a little bit. So it's really easy for us to check that Zap. And if they weren't able to build that correctly, most of the time, you know, there's some exceptions, but most of the time, those are not going to like move forward for that particular role. And so that sort of thing, I think like helps for our recruiters can pretty quickly kind of cull the pool down to people who really have not just the job titles in their resume, but kind of the specific skills and experiences. For, you know, a marketing role, it might be like, have you done this specific thing, you know, have you done like SEO for a SaaS product, whatever. A couple of those yes, no's that then like they can kind of quickly see if someone checks like basic boxes. Like, people can be dishonest, but yeah.
And I forget, I think you guys have like an assessment for most of your roles, right? Don't you have a project or an assignment for most
every
of your
role
roles?
Has some sort of skills assessment. Yeah. Like both like application questions on the front end, which I think help like cut out just a lot of the noise. I also think the people looking for a resume only app, like they're going to disengage from ours or they're not going to fill out any of it. And then we can just, you know, decline them for that. Right. So that helps like cut through the noise. We do have skills assessments for every role. I personally am a big fan of those, always have been. I know they're controversial, but to me, it's like, as someone who isn't always the best like communicator about things, I also think it's like helpful for me to be able to actually show like what I can produce versus having to just talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, we could have an argument about those all day, but I just think if it takes you 2 days to put it together, that to me is overkill.
Like, yeah, agree.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I've seen
be like,
these.
Yeah.
Put together a whole sales deck for this, you know, and I'm like, God, I just, please stop.
Yeah, I agree. Like if it's excessive,
yes,
you know, but like the one that I did to get hired here took me about probably 45 minutes
right.
max, like, and I could have done it less, but I like really, you know, went through it and wanted to do a good job. So, you know, even with like putting a lot of energy into it, it took me about 45 minutes. And it was like, respond to these 5 different scenarios with like what message you would send. And it's a really good assessment for the team to figure out quickly, like, does this person, you know, one of them was like, give feedback to a hiring manager when you notice some biased language in their scorecard. That's right. A really good topic. And it gives you so much information. Like you can kind of see, does this person pick up on what was biased there? What's the orientation towards like DEI? Some of these sorts of things, how would they communicate feedback? Are they comfortable communicating upward feedback? Those sorts of things. So,
And you know, these written prompts? Sorry to interrupt you.
This was written, again, this was like 3.5 years ago, also, I'll say.
Oh, so, okay. Because I was about to ask, has like AI?
Now you can use like AI to do it.
That's what I was curious
in. And maybe if we were hiring recruiters today, we might try something different or we might like do that live or something. Or we might say also, we're actually fine with you using AI as long as it's effective. Like,
right.
You know, so actually, I don't know if we would change it. We'd probably just have a high bar for like the quality of it and making sure it didn't sound like an AI generated.
Yeah. You know? Just don't copy and paste it.
Yeah. As long as 3 recruiters don't come back with the exact same.
That is actually like what we see happening. And that's why I tell people, like, even on our application, we say we're happy for you to use AI. Like there's now something on our application that says we like it when you use AI. But we expect integrity around it. So like if we ask how you use AI, like you should be able to talk through that. If you tell us you didn't use AI and you and 7 other people submitted the exact same thing, we're going to know you were dishonest and you're going to be declined for the dishonesty, not for the use of AI.
Yeah.
And so
huge
for us, it's more of like, and like, are you able to use it to produce a better result is like the thing that we're focused on.
Can you write a good prompt? Right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, or are you just getting the generic answer?
And like, is it in like your actual human voice?
Right.
Or when we read it, does it sound like an AI robot? And then we're going to be like, well, we don't want our team to sound like AI robots. So it's probably not like the best fit. But if you are able to use AI and then make some tweaks to make it in your voice, awesome. Like that's far more efficient than starting from scratch.
Yeah.
So, I forget where we started with this.
I don't know. We've digressed.
It was the skills assessment.
Yes.
But yes, I'm a fan, but I agree. I'm not a fan of expecting someone to like take a week off work to complete an assignment.
You know, I will say this, even if the assignment takes 45 minutes, I think it's okay for you to ask that because you have already embedded providing feedback and dedicating time to them to where it's like, we have dedicated that we'll do this for you and this is how you show up. So my issue is whenever it's, you know, 5 steps, has disparate impact, and no one's inclusion stress testing any of this. And, you know, it's just making a furl of a mess.
Yeah.
And especially if it takes up too much time, it's not worth the effort justification to even go
through
it. And now we're building a bad brand, and that's a whole
different
candidate experience back.
Yeah. I totally agree.
Yeah, so super interesting. One thing that I'm curious in kind of always, and this does tie into candidate experience, but something that I talk about a lot is like talent infrastructure, because I feel like we don't talk about it enough. And it's kind of, you know, like the inner skeletons and workings of like, how do we decide what skills are needed for this role? How do we, and especially with Zapier being kind of its own skill set to where you are able to ask people, you don't even need to bring your resume, just tell us what skills you have. So kind of walk us through if there is a company that wanted to alter their candidate experience to say, hey, we want to judge strictly on skills, like no more chronological experience is no longer the weight all the way. Walk us through kind of how you ensure that talent infrastructure and how you can assess people with such different backgrounds and still have a clear and concise and equitable assessment process for these people if they're from such different
Tools. And I want to be clear that I wouldn't say that we don't care about like experience and things like that.
I know, sorry, that's me.
Yeah, but like if a company wanted to truly do that, then I think they have to like really nail down what those skills are and have a pretty like rigorous assessment process of those like different skills. If someone like doesn't have the lived experience, because again, someone could like use AI to just say all the right things in like an interview context, but if they don't have some like record of results, if they can't bring like work samples to the table to show how they have like done those things. I think there's also like balance, like certain roles lend themselves more to just assessing skills and it doesn't really matter what someone did if they can deliver like the outcomes, like for trying to think like even engineering, it doesn't matter if you have a year of engineering experience or 10, or if you went to a top tier program or a boot camp, it's can you code these things? Like, you know, what have you produced? If you produce similar things, then you're good. Whereas, or like SEO, I know people who've taught themselves SEO, never had a formal SEO role.
Yes, absolutely. So I was going to use that as an example.
I'm like, you could probably do an SEO role for a lot of companies. And so, you know, then I think there's other types of roles where it probably does take, like you need to have had a lot of at-bats, you need to have seen a lot of different situations and cases in order to like do this well. Yeah. So I think it does kind of like vary, but I think if a company were to try to do like a purely skills-based hiring, they need to really get under what like all of those different skills are. And it's probably going to be a bigger investment of time in the interview process, both for like the candidate and the hiring team. I think there can be some challenges with these things, but I think like work trials are really cool. Obviously for employed people, that's trickier, but if you're unemployed, like you could probably just learn so much, like having a more lightweight interview process and then saying like, let's jump in, see what happens. I don't know.
Yeah. I think skills-based hiring is interesting. It's an interesting conundrum to me in a weird way. Like I would love for it to be that way, that's how we evaluated people. But I also think it's hard to get there, and how you would have to build that structure around it. It would be key. And I think that's why companies still haven't moved closer to that. But I do love the work that you guys are doing, because it gets it closer to focusing on the person's skill set, less about they went to Harvard or something like that to learn that thing.
We've definitely we've removed like the university requirement. And our CEO is actually, I think it helps that he is really a fan of non-traditional profiles for roles. Like he has said before, he's like, I love that we have so many I'm a former teacher. So it's like, I love that we have so many people who come from teaching here, because they have really like, you know, creative, they're used to having to figure out ways to do things without a lot of resources and just kind of like diving in and not having guidance for how to do every little thing. And so he's like, I just see a lot of like former educators really do well in this environment and just kind of jump in and figure stuff out. So things like that for our sales team really encourage, like, do they actually need sales experience, or like should we be looking for some of these people who just know our product really well? So we've hired some people who don't have formal sales experience, but maybe they were like a founder and they use Zapier and that sort of thing, and it's like, you know, if you were able to like use our product to run a business, you're probably really well positioned to tell other entrepreneurs how to do that too. You know, those sorts of things. So I think some of that stuff also comes from the top and like the examples that your executives are promoting.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by DEI Labs, re-educating corporate America with immersive data-driven DEI training for HR and hiring pros. Ready to shift systems and spark real change? Visit DEI-labs.com to get started. Need a resume that actually works? Resume Writing is a female-owned team of recruiting pros helping job seekers land the roles they deserve. Get expert help at resumewriting.com.
Our setting,
I love that. Yeah, so many companies do not realize how much skill is not only transferable, but sometimes that person with a ton of sales experience is not the one you need because they're going to have bad habits. They're going to have like different things to where it may not mesh. And to me, being able to, as a business, be a vessel to take people who have maybe never had experience in certain things, put them with some of the best managers in the industry and allow them to flourish and to mobilize and have a trajectory now in something that may have never been even on their radar as far as a career path, I think is extremely important. And I love to hear that it's coming from leadership down because, like I said, as an employer, they circulate the economy. They own a money clip in this whole game. So yeah, if they're only just recycling the same old talent, we're not actually propelling anything in this mission. Yeah. So I do love that that is a top-down approach of like, hey, maybe some of the best players are actually people who have been playing a few different sports but have the skill. Like, I don't know if y'all have ever seen Moneyball, but it's like, it's that theory. It's sabermetrics. It's this idea that you can have someone who is like mad good in the skill, but maybe doesn't have, you know, X, Y, Z. I've seen that at a few clients I've worked at where they've hired someone for sales that they were like, they've never done it, but they love this product. And let me tell you something, they sold more than anyone because they were intrinsically passionate. So they wouldn't shut up. Like the sale was natural for them. I think that that's excellent to hear as far as y'all's experience.
It is for me too, because I have a very nonlinear path. So I think about people like me where my resume, if you look at it, it's all over the place, right? So it would take somebody to really, to have the kind of system that you have built in to see the potential and what I could do, right? Because otherwise you're just reading some paper and you're like, what is this girl doing? Like she's all over the place, right? And so I love that there's a system to evaluate people and their skills, but also take their experience and kind of mesh those together. I think it's fantastic. I think it's great.
And I was kind of curious just because to me, the introduction into all of this, the candidate experience, I believe, according to some anecdotal data that we're collecting, does actually impact the retention of the employee long term.
Yeah.
So I am curious, how is that internally? Like, are people going through this, loving it, staying for life? Like, what is the median retention? Kind of walk us through the benefits that y'all have really benefited from by being decent at this.
Yeah. Let's see. I mean, I think we do have pretty high, like, retention. But, you know, some people, I mean, the company has, like, changed a lot. And so I think a lot of our more recent attrition has more been that people are, you know, kind of no longer aligned or something like that with some of like the focus and the priorities of the company and that kind of thing, which I think can happen. Or just cases where people have been here a long time. Like our recruiting team, every single person on our team has been here for over 3 years. So,
That's a good sign, to be quite frank. Yeah. But that means it's not a revolving door.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but at some point you start like kind of expecting attrition. And I think we're coming through a period where post-pandemic, where like layoffs were rampant. So a lot of people have been here for a long time. So the attrition stuff kind of ebbs and flows. But I do think people, you know, we get a lot of people that want to work here. And once people work here, I think people are invested. And seem to stay here. There's like good opportunities for growth. I know I don't have like this year's, I don't have like hard metrics that I can share, but like I know the last couple of years, our rate of like internal promotions and internal mobility was quite a bit higher than like the tech industry as a whole, those sorts of things. Nice. And I think a lot of that is our company is like invest in the people that are here.
Yeah, and it seems like you invested in them from the start, right? So
before they start, right?
So that's, I mean, that has to carry some weight as they go through and stay with the company or move into different roles. That initial just experience with trying to come on board, and I'm sure you guys have good onboarding too, right? Like you can't do without, right? So, and I think that that changes the way you feel about an organization. I can't say it enough. Your onboarding experience, your candidate experience before you get the job, all change the way you feel and work in a productive and in an organization. It just changes it.
Yeah, and I will say, like, statistically, data-wise, how you do your onboarding process directly indicates how long they will stay. So whenever I was referencing actually candidate experience. That's anecdotal data that we're trying to get. There is strong data talking about, like, if you put them through hazing, if you do it in a group, if you do, like, all these different settings that impact how long an employee will actually stay, very high percent of that has to do with their onboarding. Because if they come in with a group that they're allowed to have trauma bond with, then now all of a sudden they actually have a longer time of sticking it through than versus if they go through it alone, things like that. And of course, we don't want onboarding to be trauma bond, but the amount of stress that people experience when transitioning roles, it actually invokes that type of mentality in a weird way. And to be honest, I was going to say, all the people that I, you know, entered with for onboarding, those are some of my besties, like 15 years down the road, because we started on this path as like little baby recruiters. And then every company that I've worked with and been onboarded as a team, pretty much we've all stayed even without the business. So there is something to that as far as onboarding experience. But anyway, you go talk.
I was just going to say, for our own onboarding, like, we do the same where we start on 2-week cycles. And so everyone kind of starts in their first 2 weeks or is really heavy company onboarding. And so they're all getting that same access to executives, that same history of the company, that same product training. And regardless of what team they're going to be on, everyone kind of goes through a consistent set of trainings, exposure. And we also work in a lot of things. Like, I had probably not experience it to this level anywhere else, but like, we have guides for communication, and here's what goes in email, here's what goes in Slack, here's some best practices about Slack, here's some of the emojis we tend to use and what they mean, here are some of the inside jokes from the past that people will reference that, like, you understand,
so you feel a part of it.
Exactly, because there are certain things that I think have, like, emerged where if you were here 5 years ago, 6 years ago, you were here when it happened. But then if you come in 3 years later and people reference it, you're like, I don't get what they're talking about. And then it could impede your understanding of the work you're doing in some way. And so it's all, like, documented. And I was like, I've never seen this before, where now, like, when I read something, I'm like, oh, okay, I know what they're talking about. I feel like, and I feel like I can engage in this conversation. And I think it's just, like, a level of making things that are typically, like, implicit, explicit. And so everyone's on a level playing field. And because we have a global workforce, like, about our third or so of our company lives outside of the US. And so that's also, I think, important from that perspective, from, like, an equity perspective, because not everyone has, like, the same lingo, the same, like, buzzwords and jargon that they've heard. And so even sort of guidance around, or just things like, don't use acronyms, write out what they are, like, things like that, you know, just little tips that I think sometimes we don't think about. But when you have a multicultural workplace, like, it just helps make it more accessible, where someone doesn't feel like they're constantly having to ask, wait, what does that mean? Wait, you know, because early on, I think those experiences could lead someone to feel like they're behind the eight ball when they actually aren't.
One thing, Desiree, if I'm allowed to throw in a little wrench here, hopefully, and then you can guide us back. Okay, well, no, it's because there was a LinkedIn post in the wild. Bonnie commented on it, and then I commented on it on hers, because I was like, oh, snap. Okay. There was a post about someone who was doing an interview while they were on a treadmill.
I saw this one.
Okay. And so apparently, I guess the candidate had provided feedback, I believe, on Glassdoor, that was, you know, really distracting, potentially even unprofessional, things like that. If this was in Bonnie's world and happened at Zapier, like, what are the thought processes we should move through? Because I have my opinions, but my opinions are based in, like, behavioral research, like, so nitty gritty mitigating biases that, like, no one will have thought of what I will bring up after this. And I know that for fact, but I'm super curious in your take, because I think this stuff matters so much, how you're talking about these little peculiars, these tiny things of effort, of intentionality matter. So how we put structure even around ourselves or our managers whenever we are talking to candidates and creating environments for them to have a consistent process. Kind of talk to us about your thoughts, just seeing someone in the LinkedIn wild saying, you know, I'm on a treadmill doing interviews. reviews. Kind of put us in there. Talk us through that.
My response to that was I personally would find this like really irritating, and it would make me like less inclined to work for the company. And I was surprised like so many of the comments were supportive of it. But I think like where a lot of people are coming from was, well, it tells them like what kind of company you have and if that doesn't fit for them. But to me, it wasn't about like the walking, like walk all day. I don't have one right now because I was so lazy about using it that I gave it to but I have a lot of colleagues that do like the walking pad thing. I think it's fine. Like internally, do what you want to do to be as effective as you can be. But from my perspective, one, like if someone walks in an interview, they're not expecting that. Even if you are totally focused, their assumption is, oh, I was like such an afterthought that this person was like, let me do this interview during my workout. It's kind of like if you're like at dinner and you're like, I'm doing the interview from a coffee shop, right? Something like that it could feel to someone who didn't actually make time intentionally to like, you know, for them to focus on them. And if they're having that initial reaction, then to me, like they're going to be on the defensive that whole conversation, or feeling like, gosh, like, is this person even listening? They're not, you know, those sorts of things. So that's like one set of things. I also personally share that as I have both like a misophonia and I think it's, how do you say, misokinesia or whatever, I get like very annoyed by like the repetitive movements, repetitive sounds. And personally, like when someone's on a walking pad, sometimes I can hear like boom, boom, boom. And it's distracting me. And I will be losing my train of thought or unable to focus on them when they're talking. The movement would like drive me crazy as well. And so personally, I would not be able to show up as like my best self in an interview if someone was like doing that. It doesn't matter so much internally, whatever. I don't have to be my best self all the time. Like I can be a little annoyed and get through it. But in a normal meeting with someone is not a high stress environment, like an interview. Right. Where, you know, I mean, to me, if you're going to do that, I would personally, if it's so important to you to do that, then I think you should like let the person know in advance so that they're like ready for that. Maybe give them an opt out, like recognize for some people that could like really be a distraction for them and make it hard for them to focus. So, or say like, hey, let's do a camera off interview. So I'm and I will be like listening and recording notes or whatever, but you can have your camera off too. If you want to walk, you can also be walking, or, you know, something that considers the needs of both people. Whereas I felt like in that it was all about like, here's what's best for me as the executive, the decision maker, and the person in power. And I don't actually care about the impact on this other person. And actually, I'm going to criticize the other person for giving me feedback.
So yeah.
You brought up some points that I was like, oh, I didn't even like think about that with like how it could impact their interpretation of candidates. So that was, I'm not going into it just because you might, that might be what you're going to share, but I thought that was interesting as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask Desiree first. Did you have any thoughts on the treadmill brigade?
First of all, I hate them. Okay.
I hate them.
First of all, I'm very lazy. So I'm like, oh, it annoys me that you're like, I don't know. It just annoys me because I'm a lazy person. And I'm like, why are you walking? But I also find it very distracting. If somebody's head and is constantly moving, like know for me, I can't concentrate like that. My house, I can't work in chaos, if that makes any sense. And so that would be chaotic to me. It would make me feel unsettled. I just think it's so against everything I would do as an inclusive type of an interview. It just seems horrible to me. As so many neurodivergent people out there, so many people with all these other things, I find it just irresponsible behavior.
Yeah.
There's no need. I don't know how many interviews you could have in a day that you can't find another time to be doing your walking, to not give consideration to that other person. I've actually found it super rude.
Yeah.
And so I hated it. I hated the whole LinkedIn post. I was like, why would you even write this? You should take that feedback and never do this again.
I'm trying to find people to validate you.
I know. I was like, people are validating this.
It also bugged me. And all the responses were like
her response horrible.
To me. Yeah. Her response to me was essentially like, well, actually, interestingly, it helps me be more focused or something.
Know. Like, you're missing how selfish are you?
I didn't engage after that. Yeah, I was just like, all right, you're for validation right now.
Yeah, it is very, it's very self-centric. And I think the reason so many people were validating this individual in their post is because the way it was framed was like, I have back problems. And so this is how I seek comfort. And so on one end, the same empathy that we're giving to the candidate of neurodivergency potentials were also, you know, they were kind of padding that with that hiring manager as well. Yeah. Like, okay. And I think both can be true. Like, you can walk all day, lady, except for the one time that we need you. And I think because of Zoom, people have lost their mind. Would you ever sit in a room with someone and be like, hey, come on in, let's interview, and then pop and on the treadmill and be like, what's going on? And listen, no employer is paying you to be the best at exercise, all right? Yeah. Like, no one needs to be out here like, I got to get my marathon in. I got to get 13 miles today. That's your bag? Like, don't be interviewing in general, like a different day.
But oh my God.
For me, my response to this whole thing, and it was something because I read through the comments because I was like, how has no one mentioned this? But again, I also understand that I am like a behavioral data psycho. So like there's probably so many people probably never thought of it. Or if they did see it, they were probably like, girl, you're thinking way too hard. Go away. So one of the other camps. But essentially kind of what I wrote was, if you're tasked with mitigating biases and your manager is doing treadmill walks and you have no structure around it, then you are not properly mitigating biases. And the reason that I say that is because one of the main biases that we have as humans is false attribution to arousal. And so the way that researchers actually evaluate this is they take people who are going on dates and take them to scary movies. And because it made their heart rate jump, they then evaluated, okay, did you have more fun with date A or date B? Date B being the one that you watch the scary movie with a different person. And overwhelmingly, people would say date B. Why? Because their heart rate rose and they falsely attributed the heart rate that was actually happening from the movie to the experience that they were having with this other person. Because we're not very good at determining why we feel what we feel. We just know we feel it. And then the only thing different is this person. Thus, it must be them. So if you did have someone who was a decent interviewer while you're on the treadmill, then it could create impact. Because if you have a rising heart rate, you will falsely attribute that rising heart rate for excitement or whatever it may be with the candidate.
Yeah.
So, and that's like fact point proven, not necessarily always in the IO psychology corporate setting, but in many, many other settings, whether it's dating, whether it's whatever it is. So we know it for fact and science, but it was just interesting to see, because for me, I had a salesperson that would not get off a treadmill and I hated it whenever we had our internal messages. But guess what? That meant that he wasn't doing it with the candidates. So that was okay, because we put structure around it to say, you have to protect their experience. And I need to protect your biases that we know exist as well. And so if we know that bias can be physically induced, what structure do we need around this to ensure that that doesn't bear the brunt on our candidates? So anyway, not to take it to the weird level that I always do, but I definitely did. I was like, wait, lady, I want to know your data.
We just have to wait for 2 minutes on this show for Ashley to take it to the, you know, the whole weird side of things. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Thanks, Desiree. Thank you for that. That was solid. I love that feedback so much. I'm going to go write about it on LinkedIn.
Please do. Bonnie, this has been amazing and awesome. And I couldn't have better fun in the middle of my day. So first of all, I want to, can you let the people know how to find you, follow you, tune in for your words of wisdom?
Yeah, it's always like my name on every social media platform out there. So go ahead and just look for my name. And I do have a newsletter as well that I think I've linked on all of those profiles that is kind of about like job search and career development. And sometimes I'll talk about recruiting practice and things like that. But yeah, probably heavier on tips for navigating the working world and growing at work.
I love that.
Love.
Must subscribe.
And it's called Landed, right?
Landed, yes.
Landed, everyone. Yes. We're subscribing.
We are love subscribing. It. All right. So this is the part of this episode where we talk about the psychological side of what we've been talking about. Ashley, hit it off. Stuff you didn't know before.
All right, team. For stuff you didn't know before, it is related to candidate experience, because candidate experience is deeply rooted in psychology and understanding the factors that impact. It can help recruiters and companies create better, more human-centric processes. Here are a few key psychological factors that influence how candidates perceive and respond to their experience during the hiring process. So one is going to be called perceived fairness, and that is essentially, does the candidate believe that your process is intrusive intrinsically fair in assessing what you say it is. The reason that this matters is candidates can assess whether the process feels procedurally fair, distributively fair, and interactionally fair, which is like how decisions are made, who gets what, and how they are treated. The impact of this on candidates, a process that feels opaque or dismissive creates resentment and brand damage. Even rejected candidates will respect fair treatment. The next one that is a key factor is autonomy and control. Why does this matter? Humans dislike feeling powerless. Job searching already feels that way. Adding vague timelines and unclear processes amplifies anxiety. Giving an impact on candidates that giving clarity for next steps for who they'll meet in the timelines gives candidates a sense of control and reduces the perceived stress. And lastly is psychological safety. Does it matter? Because candidates open up more when they feel safe, not when they feel judged or tricked. And the impact on candidates is that those gotcha interview questions or unprepared panels erode safety, psychological safety specifically. So curated human interactions encourage better, more honest exchanges. So that is the stuff you didn't know with the three pillars of candidate experience that can impact your candidate's psyche.
Well, thank you again. Thank you again, Bonnie. And we'll see you next time or hear you next time. Listen, please, to Talentless. You can find us wherever you find your podcasts and at talentlesspodcast.com. Thank you so much.
Well,
I'm Desiree.
And I'm Ashley. And thanks for listening to Talentless, where we keep it real in the world of HR.
If you loved what you heard, don't forget to hit subscribe and give us a follow on Blue Sky, Instagram, and LinkedIn. We're here to keep your feed packed with everything you need to level up in recruitment and HR.
And be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And hey, don't miss out. Sign up for our newsletter for fresh insights and follow us on socials to stay connected with both Ashley and me.
Thanks again for joining us on Talentless. Until next time, we'll see you then.